And that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. rate hikes are doing more to devastate Asian economies and currencies than tame U.S. inflation and overheating. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by William Pesek titled "Powell Pushing Asia into a New Financial Crisis." Please stay with us to hear more about the details. The mid-1990s vibe emanating from Federal Reserve headquarters in Washington is becoming harder for dollar bulls to dismiss. In the short run, the Fed's decision to hike interest rates on Wednesday, July 27th by 75 basis points, not a full percentage point, was greeted by investors as welcome news. However, what's not is how Fed Chairman Jerome Powell's past mistakes are about to wreck the second half of Asia's 2022. Powell is surely determined to make up lost ground, namely, for sitting back in 2021 and calling U.S. inflation transitory instead of confronting it with sizable rate hikes back when it might have made a difference. Former Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke told CNBC, the question is, why did they delay that? Why did they delay their purpose? I think in retrospect, yes, it was a mistake. And I think they agree it was a mistake. Though coming now as consumer prices surge at a 9.1% pace, the 150 basis points worth of monetary breaking the Fed has done since June, the biggest move since mid-1990s, and more hikes on the way will do more to devastate Asia's next 6 months than tame U.S. overheating risks. Rising U.S. rates put China's giant export engine at risk. It complicates things for highly indebted mainland property developers struggling to avoid default. And then there is the nearly $1 trillion of state wealth parked in U.S. government debt. The yen's dwindling value, down 18% so far this year, is a crisis in slow motion for Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and Bank of Japan Governor Hirokino Korda. Asia's number two economy is importing increasing waves of inflation via food and energy markets. The Thai baht is already down more than 10% against the dollar this year. In Manila, the new Ferdinando Marcos Jr. regime is struggling with the peso down 9.3%. As cost of food and other vital items surge, millions of Philippine families who escaped poverty over the last decade risk sliding back under the line. Both the Malaysian ringgit and Indian rupee are down nearly 7%, while the Indonesian rupiah has lost 5% of its value. The yuan is down more than 9.5% this year, causing its own headaches for the Bank of Korea. From Taiwan to Vietnam, powerful capital outflows into higher-yielding dollar investments are adding to pressures on Asian governments. As Asia braces for more to come, traders are buzzing about a reverse currency war whereby central banks favor stronger exchange rates to reduce imported inflation risks. Harvard University economist Jeffrey Frankel says it's easier said than done. Frankel says a fallout from runaway dollar strength, it is impossible for all countries to pursue such strategies because they cannot all move their exchange rates in the same direction at the same time. Ironically, the U.S. Congress on Wednesday, July 27th, hours after the Fed tightened, showed Powell a so-called better way to save the day. The Senate moved to deploy $52 billion in subsidies to semiconductor manufacturers and reinvigorate science and technology to raise productivity. Its broader $280 billion Chips and Science Act endeavors to boost competitiveness at a moment when China is investing trillions in owning the future of innovation. Many of the price pressures imperiling U.S. growth are coming from the supply side, from COVID-19 disruptions to surging commodity prices to Russia-Ukraine conflict to weak tech investment. The Fed, of course, has very little influence over steps by government and industry to increase economic efficiency. China is spending trillions of dollars to dominate the future of semiconductors. Biotechnology, 5G, electric vehicles, aviation, artificial intelligence, renewable energy, and green infrastructure. It's all a part of President Xi Jinping's Made in China 2025 scheme. In the meantime, Powell's Fed is now engaged in a 1990s-style battle with the ghost of bad decisions past. The worst, arguably, was Powell caving to politics in 2019 when his team began cutting interest rates when the U.S. least needed it. In August 2019, when Powell gave in to then-President Donald Trump, U.S. growth was buoyant, stocks were up, and the job market was sizzling. Trump, though, was enraged the Fed was raising rates on his watch. That rate hike cycle started in 2015 when Janet Yellen chaired the Fed. After meticulously ending post-Lehman crisis quantitative easing, the Yellen Fed in December 2015 boosted rates for the first time since 2006. Powell pushed on with normalizing U.S. rates after replacing Yellen in February 2018. Then the Fed got Trump. In speeches and tweets, Trump attacked Powell's rate hikes, even threatening to fire his hand-picked Fed chief. Powell acquiesced and began lowering rates. That U-turn had three negative consequences. One was adding liquidity the globe's biggest economy didn't need. Second, it wasted monetary ammunition the Fed couldn't use when the pandemic hit. Then there is the three. Number three, it did give damage to the perception of Fed independence. This latter problem makes today's echoes of the 1990s all the more relevant. The Fed's 1994 to 1995 tightening cycle under then-chairman Alan Greenspan greatly angered the Washington political establishment. His doubling of short-term rates in just 12 months caused great collateral damage in Mexico, on Wall Street, in municipalities around the U.S., and especially in Asia. The dollar's rally then as now put Asia at grave risk. By 1997, the strain on dollar pegs from Bangkok to Jakarta to Seoul became impossible to defend. A wave of devastations and devaluations set in motion the 1997 to 98 Asian financial crisis. Is history about to repeat itself? After 2 75-tenth percentage point hikes in short succession, Powell's team seems to be setting the stage for a full 1 percentage point hike in the weeks ahead. Washington's fiscal position raises the stakes. With U.S. debt now well above $30 trillion, the fallout from the aggressive Fed hikes could be far bigger now than in the 1990s. This speculation virtually ensures the U.S. will continue to hoover up capital from all corners of the globe. The outflows are sure to accelerate as the Fed signals more assertive taps on the monetary brakes. Economist Jonathan Fortin at the Institute of International Finance views these actions as part of a perfect storm of risk for markets anywhere. Fortin says, mounting global recession risk is weighing on emerging market flows as anxiety builds over geopolitical events, tighter monetary conditions, and realized inflation. Adding, the continued volatility in equity markets has hurt the outlook considerably. Fortin notes that we are in a global interest rate and high inflation shock in the second half of 2022, adding, longer dated government bond yields have risen sharply across advanced economies, tightening financial conditions, weighing on growth, and pushing up risk aversion. This mechanism is weighing on flows to emerging markets. We see that the current outflow episode is similar in scale to the RMB devaluation scare in 2015 and 2016. Ravi Menon, who heads the Monetary Authority of Singapore, is sounding the alarm about the impact of a strong dollar 25 years after the 97-98 crisis. Menon's team finds that a 1% appreciation of the US dollar is associated with net capital outflows of 0.3% of emerging market GDP in the following quarter. This argues poorly for growth in emerging Asia. In Indonesia, the Philippines and Thailand currencies are sliding at accelerating rates just as surging global commodity prices are raising inflation risks. Already, Philippine inflation exceeds 6%, well above government targets. That has the Marcos government struggling out of the gate with twin food and energy crises. Of course, the Fed had myriad opportunities throughout 2021 to make down payments against inflation. Even though many of today's pressures come from the supply side, Fed inaction enabled the trend. It could have sent any number of monetary shots across the bows of corporate CEOs angling to hike prices or speculators driving commodities higher. At the very least, acting might have rebuilt some of the Fed credibility Powell lost bowing to Trump's demands. Now, as Powell races to make up for lost time, Asia is directly in harm's way. Some economists, including former Goldman Sachs analyst Jim O'Neill, worry a continued yen slide could force China to devalue. O'Neill thinks that's all too possible if the yen heads toward 150 to the dollar. Japan's $1.45 trillion government pension investment fund could start reporting sizable losses thanks to the yen's drop. Meanwhile, Japan's government is cobbling together yet another massive fiscal stimulus package to support flatlining growth. The US, UK, and Australia won't be far behind as global headwinds hit business confidence. These fiscal realities and fallout from the wrecking ball dynamics surrounding the dollar could have unpredictable geopolitical fallout.
A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mirail neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mirail is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators.
Don't hang about here, right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now.
Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside. Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often. They call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but as you saw, they're on public property, and we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. Sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Sadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change. They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did was stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents. They'd go and visit the neighbors. All sorts of different mixes of people. But slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come, because they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself. Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the 6th floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just 2 floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. There are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45-square-meter apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town, and it's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet, you can walk around. And there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's... the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside. When they need to shout, kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me. It's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes.
Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once. But my neighbour's camera picked him up.
In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods. If you can't, you won't have them. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where the economy is booming. The country, though, is cut into two. The middle classes have flocked into enclosed areas, condominiums, entire sectors behind high railings and armed guards. Brazil is copying Florida with its gated communities, enclosed villages. Right next to the condominiums are the world's largest slums. Two nations, that of the rich and the poor, who live on either side of the ramparts. Thais and her mother always lived in the so-called condominios. Well, the idea for condominios came from keeping people closed off, but with hobbies and things to do on the inside. There's a bar where you can meet your friends. It's also to be close to each other without needing to go out or risk being attacked. Why? Because the streets are considered dangerous? Yes, especially at night. And you can't be at the mercy of other people in the streets. Unfortunately, that's today's reality. So they found the way to mix safety with hobbies and pastimes. It's like being outside. In fact, a whole generation is growing up inside the condominiums that will never get to know the real Brazil. It's true. I really think we've created gilded cages like this one. We're prisoners of luxury. I really wish my children were as lucky as I was. I grew up in an apartment block, but we used to play out in the streets. I had that freedom. Today, if I go past the same area where I grew up, I see it's no longer possible. Everyone's a bit more enclosed nowadays. Right alongside the condominiums are the favelas. It's the Brazil of the workers and cleaning women, as well as armed teenagers who live off the drugs trade. They form an alternative kind of justice in these forgotten slums. Shaolin has been in charge of the residents' association for a long time. To him, segregation is the worst form of violence. More than the physical wall that separates us, there's the invisible social wall, which is far more hurtful. The superior classes in their buildings, and we, people of no class, in our huts. Right next to each other. The city has to integrate, otherwise there'll be chaos. Directly opposite the huge favela Rocinha on the São Conrado beach are some of the most expensive housing estates in Brazil. They're not just criminals up there. There are some better people up there than there are down here. More honest people. One day, Augusta witnessed a shootout between cocaine traffickers and military police. A scene from a war film. There was a problem fairly recently between the guys from the Vidigal favela and those from Rocinha. They encountered the military police and there was a fight.
They ran off, and in the confusion, they crossed and went out the other side. That's it. They caused no trouble. They just crossed through. You know, the wall, it's not real security. There are 500,000, 400,000 of them, and just 10,000 of us. If they come down, nothing will stop them. On the other side of the railings, the government decided to seize control of the favelas. In November 2010, the army and its armored cars are called in. 4 days of fighting in the north zone eventually forces the traffickers out. The government troops hoist the national colors, a symbol of the victory of one nation over another. Today, Captain Felipe Barreto and his men are on patrol to prevent the gangs from returning. I don't know any city like Rio, with the rich right next to the poor, literally wall to wall. The social impact is very negative. You see down there, where the car is? Before, the police wouldn't have been able to go there. 20 meters away, they'd shoot at you. Just one cop on the corner and they'd open fire. So that was the border? Yeah, that was the border. And what about the other public services? Can they come in? Firemen, postmen, doctors? Well, before, it was only with the permission of the traffickers. So it was a parallel government. Exactly. The media used to call it parallel powers. Are there less now? Oh, yeah. Many were killed. And they fled as well, right? Yeah, all were arrested. Others moved to Rocinha. Rocinha is home to countless thousands of poor. Among them, some heavily armed young men. The traffickers tolerated our presence on their territory so long as we never filmed them. And we were given escorts. One longtime member of the drug world does, however, agree to be interviewed. Nowadays, Regis has stopped dealing. He's settled down, has a family and work, and tries to lead a dignified life. Like most dealers, Regis was also an addict. I took a lot of drugs for 10 years. From the ages of 15 to 26, I hit rock bottom. A lot of cocaine, alcohol. Oh, it lasted for 10 years. I lost my friends, traffickers, thieves. I used to live among all of that. They call me the last of the Mohicans. Why? Because the rest of my generation are all dead. For many of the favela's youngsters, drugs remains the easiest career move. With the intoxicating feeling the street belongs to you. They are arrogant and well-armed, but few will live to see 30. They will be killed by the police or rival gangs. People used to look at me differently. They'd look away when they saw me. My own mother didn't trust me anymore. But thanks to God, I was able to get out of it. Now I have my daughter, my wife, my house and my work. It must be a struggle. Yeah, it is a struggle. But the most important thing is to have abandoned the drug scene. The favelas issue is about successive governments having basically abandoned them. It's just government negligence. That's why we're in the state we're in today.
After having assaulted the area, the police tries to do some social work. A community police unit has set up in the middle of the favela. It's aimed to stop the drug gangs returning. We arrive, we set up, and then we determine what the needs are, and we try and get back into the areas that have been abandoned by the state. Yeah, by the state and by society in general. Captain Barreto's men have established an advance base at the top of the favela. It's a strategic position with a bird's eye view over the condominiums. And Baghdad, the city of 1,000 walls. After 8 years of war, a fragile peace exists behind these concrete ramparts. The walls crisscross the city over hundreds of kilometers, causing never-ending detours. Abu Hazem is a taxi driver in the Daura district, which was controlled by insurgents back in 2007. I have to go around the wall, go to the end of the motorway, and come all the way back. It's like a huge prison. It's bad for morale, too. Does the wall make it safer? Does it bring work? Well, in fact, the wall has made it safer. Before, no one could pass here. It was too dangerous. Between 2003 and 2007, Iraq was ravaged by an incredibly vicious civil war. U.S. soldiers were constantly targeted. Certain areas were completely controlled by the insurgents. Then the Shiite and Sunni militias began killing each other. According to The Lancet, a respected medical journal, 600,000 civilians were killed. That's when the Americans conceived of the idea of building walls around the most violent areas. They would contain the insurrection and separate the Sunnis from the Shiites. Baghdad would resemble Berlin during the time of the wall. The U.S. Army spokesman, however, confirms they are also building gated housing, like the retired people's homes in California.
We're building different walls all throughout the city here, different communities, and you've heard the concept of gated communities.
Mm-hmm. Funny, a gated community, to me, just connotes, you know, an exclusive sort of Coral Gables, Florida kind of setup, which is not what you mean, is it?
The gated communities are designed to protect the population in selected neighborhoods throughout Baghdad.
Many of them don't like it at all. They feel that it will further divide the city on sectarian lines.
Well, the intent is not to divide the city on sectarian lines. Once again, the intent is to provide a more secure neighborhood for the people that live in selected neighborhoods. And if we find areas that we think that the gated communities will do good and will control the population, we'll probably build more.
Each zone is surrounded by a wall. It's like living on a reserve. We're stuck inside. The wall was the Americans' idea. It was American material and vehicles that were used to build it. There never was the split between Sunnis and Shiites before the Americans arrived. Sunnis, Shiites, Christians and Jews, we were all Iraqis first. And the first thing the Americans ask you now is, are you Shiite or Sunni?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The West seems more fixated on spending social wealth on the military rather than addressing the climate catastrophe. The money that is being poured into the Western military establishments does not only drift away from any climate spending, but also promotes greater climate catastrophe. The U.S. military is the largest institutional polluter on the planet. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Murad Qureshi, a former member of the London Assembly and a former chairman of the Stop the War Coalition, titled $2 Trillion for War versus $100 Billion to Save the Planet. Please stay with us to hear more about the details. During late April and early May, South Asia experienced the terrible impacts of global warming. Temperatures reached almost 50 degrees Celsius in some cities in the region. These high temperatures came alongside dangerous flooding in northeast India and in Bangladesh, as the rivers burst their banks, with flash floods occurring in such places as Sunamganj in Sylhet, Bangladesh. Samuel Haq, the director of the International Center of Climate Change and Development, is from Bangladesh. He's a veteran of the UN climate negotiations. When Haq read a tweet by Marianne Carlson, the co-chairwoman of the UN's Adaptation Committee, which said that more time is needed to reach an agreement while referring to the negotiations on loss and damage finance, he tweeted, "The one thing we have run out of is time. Climate change impacts are already happening, and poor people are suffering losses and damages due to the emissions of the rich. Talk is no longer an acceptable substitute for action." Carson's comment came in light of the trickle slow process of agreement on the loss and damage agenda for the 27th Conference of Parties, meeting to be held in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, this November. In 2009, at COP15, developed countries of the world had agreed to a $100 billion annual adaptation assistance fund, which was supposed to be paid by 2020. This fund was intended to help countries of the Global South to shift their reliance on carbon to renewable sources of energy and to adapt to the realities of the climate catastrophe. However, at the time of the Glasgow COP26 meeting in November 2021, developed countries were unable to meet this commitment. The $100 billion may seem like a modest fund, but is far less than the $1 trillion climate finance challenge that will be required to ensure comprehensive climate action. The richer states led by the West have not only refused to fund adaptation seriously, but they have also reneged on the original agreements, such as the Kyoto Protocol. The U.S. Congress has refused to ratify this important step toward mitigating the climate crisis. The United States has shifted the goalpost for reducing its methane emissions and has refused to account for the massive output of carbon emissions by the U.S. military. Germany hosts the Secretariat of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. In June, as a prelude to COP27, the UN held a conference in Bonn on climate change. The talks ended in acrimony over the finance for what is known as loss and damage. The European Union consistently blocked all discussions on compensation. Eddie Press, of the Climate Action Network in Canada said, consumed by their narrow interest, rich nations, and in particular countries in the European Union, came to the Bonn Climate Conference to block, delay, and undermine efforts from people and communities on the front lines addressing the losses and damage caused by fossil fuels. On the table is the hypocrisy of countries such as Germany, which claims to lead on these issues, but instead has been sourcing fossil fuels overseas and has been spending increasing funds on its military. At the same time, these countries have denied support to developing countries, facing devastation from climate-induced superstorms and rising seas. After the recent German elections, hopes were raised that the new coalition of the Social Democrats with the Green Party would lift up the green agenda. However, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has promised 100 billion euros for the military, the biggest increase in the country's military expenditure since the end of the Cold War. He has also committed to spending more than 2% of the country's gross domestic product on the military. This means more money for the military and less money for climate mitigation and green transformation. The money that is being poured into the Western military establishments does not only drift away from any climate spending, but also promotes greater climate catastrophe. The U.S. military is the largest institutional polluter on the planet. The maintenance of its more than 800 military bases around the world, for instance, means that the U.S. military consumes 395,000 barrels of oil daily. In 2021, the world's governments spent $2 trillion on weapons, with the leading country being those that are the richest, as well as the most sanctimonious on the climate debate. Money is available for war, but not to deal with the climate catastrophe. Murad Qureshi wrote, "The way weapons have poured into Ukraine conflict gives many of us pause." According to the Hunger Hotspots report by the United Nations agencies, the prolongation of that war has placed 49 million more people at risk of famine in 46 countries. Conflict and organized violence were the main sources of food insecurity in Africa and West Asia, specifically in northern Nigeria, Central Sahel, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, Yemen, and Syria. The conflict in Eastern Europe has exacerbated the food crisis by driving up the price of agricultural commodities. Russia and Ukraine together account for around 30% of the global wheat trade. So the longer the conflict continues, the more hunger hotspots will grow, taking food insecurity beyond just Africa and West Asia. While one COP meeting has already taken place on the African continent, another will take place this year. First, Abidjan hosted the UN Convention to Combat Desertification in May, and then Sharm el-Sheikh will host the UN Climate Change Conference. These are major forums for African states to put on the table the great damage done to parts of the continent due to the climate catastrophe. Murad Qureshi concluded, when the representatives of the countries of the world gather at Sharm el-Sheikh in November for COP27, they will hear Western representatives talk about climate change, make pledges, and do everything possible to continue to exacerbate the catastrophe. What we saw in Bonn is a prelude to what will be a fiasco in Sharm el-Sheikh.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
Besides the overall movement of the Islamic Republic, women have especially struck one of the most important blows to the West's lies and false claims. How? For many years, about 200 years, the West has said that if women are not freed from moral and religious boundaries and coverings, they cannot progress and reach higher scientific, political and social positions. This is what they are saying. They are saying that women must be freed from these moral limits if they are to reach a high rank in society, politics and other areas. Iranian women have exposed the falsity of this in practice. Iranian women have been present in all fields achieving success and glory, and all the while wearing the Islamic hijab. This isn't just boasting. These are the tangible realities of our society. Half or more than half of our university students are our girls and women. In important scientific organizations, some of which I have visited myself, our female scholars work in key scientific centers.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In literature and poetry, books and biographies, women are amongst the most outstanding. It is the same in athletic competitions. Sometimes one is truly unable to praise them the way they deserve to be praised. We have Iranian women standing on the winner's podium, the Iranian flag being raised and the national anthem being played before the eyes of hundreds of millions of television viewers around the world, and she is wearing hijab. She does not shake hands with the man who comes forward to give her the medal. That is, she observes the religious limits. Is this something small? I will give an example in the field of politics. When the Soviet Union was still in power, in one of the most important diplomatic missions that took place between the two countries, Imam Khomeini dispatched three envoys. One of them was a woman, and what a strong woman she was. May Allah's mercy be upon her. In the management of national affairs, our women have shown the best management in their activities whilst wearing hijab and the chador. In scientific matters and literary issues, in hosting television programs and in various other fields, Iranian women have been present and advanced to the highest levels whilst wearing the Islamic hijab and observing the hijab. This is something very important.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Britain has a new monarch. King Charles III used his first address to the nation since taking the throne to pay tribute to his late mother.
Queen Elizabeth was a life well lived, a promise with destiny kept, and she is mourned most deeply in her passing. That promise of lifelong service I renew to you all today.
Earlier, the new king, alongside Queen Consort Camilla, met well wishers gathered outside Buckingham Palace, paying their respects after the passing of Queen Elizabeth II on Thursday. Gun salutes, floral tributes, and flags flying at half-mast symbolized the country in the first phase of an official 12-day mourning period. Messages of condolences flooded in from world leaders, with domestic tributes being led in the House of Commons by the new Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Today, we show the world that we do not fear what lies ahead. We send our deepest sympathy to all members of the royal family. We pay tribute to our late Queen, and we offer loyal service to our new King.
These are unprecedented times, and the parliamentarians will be getting used to saying God save the King instead of God save the Queen. But what will a monarchy under the stewardship of Charles III really look like? Charles's ascension to the throne comes following a 7-decade-long reign by the late monarch.
Lots of people who maybe were not great fans of the monarchy as an institution respected Queen Elizabeth II for her longevity, for her record. They forgot many of the things that she was also associated with, the end of empire, which is often very brutal in places like Kenya. But they gave her some respect, and you'll see that, I think, over the next 12 days. You'll see people prepared to give that respect to the Queen. I think it's going to be a very different story going down the road, and we should remember that the monarchy is very important to the British elite. The armed forces, the security services, judiciary, they swear loyalty not to Parliament, but to the monarchy.
Charles's new role as king comes at not just a tumultuous time for the throne, but for the country itself.
If he's going to be an effective king, he will have to speak to the nation in a way that brings people together. And that may involve him, and as Charles has known to do this in the past, be a very much more politically, overly political monarch than some of his predecessors. He's made interventions on various issues, and I think he'll continue to do that going forward.
At home and abroad, there are questions about what Britain's new monarch's vision will be. Will the tentacles of the new reign bring forth a new dawn? Former subjects across the world will simply wait and see. Amina Taylor, London.
A shroud of terror has descended onto the streets of Leicester, with Muslim residents of the English town living in fear for their very safety. Racism, cricket hooliganism, and violent street assaults, all targeting Muslims of mostly Pakistani origin, has become commonplace in this once peaceful city. Amid the hate crime spike, Press TV was informed by concerned locals that the attacks appear to be conducted by Hindu thugs radicalized by foreign extremism. At this stage, we cannot verify the political affiliations of the perpetrators. However, speaking to local Muslim residents, they've expressed major concerns that what might be inspiring this latest round of attacks could be Hindutva supremacism from India. The rise of anti-Muslim violence taking place over there could have a ripple effect affecting the Indian diaspora community, particularly here in the UK, which boasts a sizable British Indian community. Hindutva has become a significant ideology inside India, seeking to establish Hindu hegemony over the country. Many of its advocates preach intolerance towards rival religions.